David Bedford is a Beatles historian. He's the first guest that I've had the pleasure to interview twice. The first, we talk about kind of the early part of the Beatles, and he has got great stories. Now we kind of move over into the mid to the late Beatles from Revolver and Rubber Soul on, and we talk about the Red and the Blue album, and he gives these tours in Liverpool. His thesis is, as I mentioned before, you can't understand the Beatles unless you understand Liverpool. But he has great insight. The Peter Jackson documentary at the time of the recording is about to be released. Very excited that 6 hours of all the Let It Be sessions. But the Beatles Part 2 with David Bedford, he released just two new books. His website, his YouTube, chock full of just Beatles information. And if you're in the Liverpool area, please go see him. Get a face-to-face tour. He'll bring you to the Cavern. He'll bring you, not to the Cavern, that's in Germany, of course, but other places that the Beatles were. Really enjoyed this conversation with David Bedford. Thanks for listening. Hi, I'm Joey Pins. People ask me, how did I lose 130 pounds? The quick answer is always discipline. I started my business, wasn't paying attention to my health, was eating too much, drinking too much sweets. My daughter was born. Next thing I know, I'm pre-diabetic, I have hypertension. I knew something had to change. Discipline. I, like many of you, have faced many challenges in your career, in your family, in your life, in your faith. How did you attack them? How did you approach them? How did you solve them, hopefully? It all had to have some degree of discipline. I'm also asked, how did you found and start a tech business that lasted over 25 years? Discipline. I was committed to it, enjoyed technology, didn't enjoy some aspects of it, but knew it was necessary. Discipline. Our podcast mission, how do we use discipline to better ourselves and society? Join me, please, as I talk to interesting people and discuss how they use discipline in their family, in their passion, in their careers, and how it helped them. Our podcast vision, growth through learning from others. Joey Pins Discipline Conversations. It'll be light and serious. Join us, please. Thank you for consideration.
Good. Thank you very much.
I'm going to start recording. It's great to see and hear you again. You're doing well?
I'm doing good, thanks. Yeah, yeah. No, it's good to catch up again. It's brilliant.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. How is it over there? It's getting better. Doors are opening up. Are you doing more tours, face-to-face tours?
Yeah, they've done a few. Had a first Americans this year. Well, it's in nearly 2 years, isn't it? Which is great. The two sisters, absolutely lovely. Spent the day with them. Had a great time. It was really good. It was nice.
Well, we are planning to come there summer of 22, so I hope we get to go there, and I will certainly let you know, and I look forward to meeting up and having a pint.
Too right. Definitely. We will do that, my friend. Definitely. I'll take you around.
I can't wait. Even, my daughters, do you know how they got introduced to the Beatles? We have something called Rock Band, which is a part of Xbox where you play like these fake instruments.
Oh, yeah.
And so there was a Beatles version that came out, when they were young, and it just rocketed them into it. They know all the songs. And to this day, it was one of the best things that ever happened in the household. It was wonderful.
Yeah. It was very, very popular, wasn't it?
Oh, so you remember it?
I remember that coming out. It was a big, big thing at the time. It really was.
Very, very cool. So we had a great conversation last time. You had some really, really great stories about a Holy Grail and, what happened there. And, I wanted to talk about the albums that I saw a complete transition in their music and their style. To me was Rubber Soul and Revolver.
Yeah, definitely.
And I grew to love those albums. And as I got older, I'm talking in high school, maybe college, I saw my friends had the Beatles Red and Beatles Blue albums.
I remember those well.
I was appalled by
this. Oh,
yeah, you
I
did?
I grew up with those, yeah. Because, of course, I wasn't around in the 60s when the Beatles were bringing their albums out. because I was born 65. So the Beatles albums I knew were the Red and the Blue albums. You know, and of course, they were brilliant because they had all the singles on.
Right.
That was the beauty of them. If the Beatles were releasing a single, that song would not appear on an album. Now that, back then, was revolutionary. It'd be unheard of today. Because you know what it's like now? You know, you bring out an album, then you can have four or five songs from the album will come out as a single. So, excuse me just one second, because as you can hear, my dog has decided now is the time to come and bark.
What is the dog's name? Ringo?
Roxy. Oh, yeah. Roxy.
You would have to pick that one.
I suppose it should have been Martha after Paul McCartney's dog, shouldn't it?
Martha, my dear, yeah.
Martha, my dear.
So, yeah, I was born in 68, as we talked about, but I had my mother's original albums. I found them. So when I saw the Red and Blue later on, so the Red was 62 to 66, and Blue was 67 to 70. So the dividing line was Rubber Soul and Revolver.
Yeah, and the time at end of touring as well. Because that's the important bit. Because once they stopped touring, 29th of August, 66, wow. Candlestick Park, San Francisco. That was the last ever gig. Ironically and coincidentally, exactly 7 years to the day from when the Quarrymen opened the Casbah Club in Liverpool, 29th of August, 1959. There's lots of these coincidences. And so the beauty was, because they stopped touring, they could then devote time to the studio. So they then spend, in the end, from when they start working on what becomes Sgt. Pepper, they were already working that sort of September, October, 66. Wow. That doesn't come out until my second birthday. Just say, 1st May of June, 67. They brought it out. That was a present to me from the Beatles. I said, oh, great, Dave's too. Let's bring the album out on his birthday, which was nice.
It's very considerate. Very considerate. Well,
and that's why they put the lyrics on the album for the very first time to help me to learn to read.
I couldn't. I mentioned that last time. I opened up that, you know, the double. It was only a single album, but it was a double, you know, open. And I.
Eightfold, yeah.
And I, as it folded, and I read each one of those, going through each of the songs, and they're all there in their outfits. And Paul's the only one with his knees up, and everybody else is down. But so Rubber Soul 65. And then coincidentally, Pet Sounds comes out of May of 66. And that was highly influenced, especially by Paul.
Well, the beauty, when you look at the three albums, Rubber Soul, Pet Sounds, Revolver. Now, personally, I love the Beach Boys,
yeah.
By the way. Always been a fan. And I've seen the sort of the more recent lineup a couple of times in Liverpool. Yeah, absolutely fantastic. Loved them. But I don't like Pet Sounds.
Interesting.
You know, and this was always held up as this was the great thing that the Beatles loved and therefore influenced them. And I listened to it and thought, I don't quite get it. I don't quite like the album, which surprised me as a Beach Boys fan. I thought, but I just couldn't get into the album. But you could see the link of Rubber Soul coming out and Brian Wilson, you know, his head was scrambled and thinking, wow. I mean, Brian Wilson, absolute genius. You know, when you watch the film of how they just made Good Vibrations, I mean, that in itself is phenomenal, how they did that with the limited technology back then.
Right.
So you could see, you know, the Beatles had, and this is what I love about the Beatles as well, is every album was different. Every time they weren't satisfied to just say, well, let's do the same as the last one because it sold. No, they wanted to push the boundary each time. And as you say, Rubber Soul's a game changer. No doubt about that. That you can see then challenges Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys. Pet Sounds comes out. And John and Paul are thinking, oh, okay. You want to do that? We're going to do this. And I think, and that's part of the genius of them, and part of also what kept the Lennon-McCartney songwriting partnership. So, so good.
Really?
It was because they were different. Paul would just get the inspiration and he'd write. Mm. John was lazy. And they'd be thinking about a new album. They'd get up, meet in the studio, and Paul would say, right, I've got 8 songs. And John would think, what? Right, I better go and write some songs. And so, and that would be the impetus for John to go off and write some songs.
Right.
And I think that's one of those key things when you go back to that very first meeting at St. Peter's Church Fete in July 57. That's what Paul brought to John. John quite possibly would have been content just to keep doing what he was doing, and he'd drift. Paul straight away said, no, as it's you and me doing the singing, I think the two of us should stand at the front. Okay, yeah. And then Paul says, I'm thinking of wearing a jacket. Well, if he's wearing a jacket, I'm wearing a jacket. So immediately there's a change. You know, and that is quite a radical change by the end of 57, the fact that, you know, George Harrison's in the group. Most of those who were playing in the Quarrymen the day Paul first saw them were gone. He brought that professionalism, which John needed, and he knew he needed. And I think that was always reflected in their progress, is that Paul was so, so good, just to almost incite John to go off and be creative. And then John was like, okay, right, if he's going to have these songs, I'm going to go and write some. And that's why I think they bounced off each other, but they loved the challenge. And how they started songwriting in Liverpool is because there were so many groups here in a small city and everybody's doing the same songs. And Paul said, well, he and John, you know, they've been experimenting with songwriting. We said, if we're going to stand out, if we perform our own songs, no other group's going to be able to copy them. That was one of their biggest incentives for writing more of their own songs. Really, in that sort of 1961 period onwards. So there's always being aware of the opposition. Jerry and the Pacemakers were so close to being on a par with the Beatles. That, and that's what Paul said, we were always looking over our shoulder at them. We wanted to get the record deal before they did because they knew how good they were. So that it's that healthy competition that drives you on. And I think that's what... that Rubber Soul Pet Sounds Revolver, that's what that does. You know, if you, if you're up there and, like John was saying, you know, no one I think is in my tree, you know, no one's on my wavelength, who's got to inspire them to greatness? Because they could have sat back and just kept doing the same thing, but they just wanted to keep improving and getting better and getting better all the time. There's too many puns in all this, isn't there?
Yes, it is. I'm catching every one. It's amazing. His work ethic, Paul's work ethic, was incredible. And yeah, he was so dedicated. It was absolutely amazing. So in 65, you have Rubber Soul. I have it as December. In May of 66, Pet Sounds. So Wouldn't It Be Nice, God Only Knows, Sloop John B, right? These songs. So they see that and they make Revolver in August of 66, with 4 months later. And by the way, record company being what they are, squeeze Y and Yesterday and Today right in between that.
Yeah, I mean, that was always the thing they hated, was the fact that Capitol, even though the part of the EMI group, would just take maybe 10 of the 14 songs on a UK album and make two albums somehow and mess them around, and know how much that really annoyed them. And I saw something, it was yesterday or day before, is it Adele or someone who's said to Spotify to take off the whole thing of shuffle the album?
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, because you're saying we spend so much time not just writing and recording the songs, but we put them in a certain order for a reason. And if you just then shuffle them, you don't get the impact that we've put into the creative process. And that's what really annoyed John and Paul with the Capitol records that came out. He said, we put all those together. We selected those for the album. And we selected those to be in that particular order for a reason. And they didn't do that. They butchered it.
so frustrating because when I think of, you know, when I think of Revolver, first thing I think of is I've just seen a face. But that was that was supposed to be released on Help in 65. But I don't think of that. The first song, when I had the vinyl, I put it on, I've just seen a face. And that's what they didn't like that at all. That's not what they had in mind.
Exactly. And that's the whole thing. It's because for every album, they will have this pot of songs. So the first thing you do is get down to, right, these are going to be the dozen that we're going to put on there. And they'll be deliberately put on there for certain reasons. Others will be left and moved. But they'll say, right, these are the ones that we want to put together for this album. And then we want to put them in this order for a very specific reason. And when a record company then does away with all that, that really used to bug them. And you can understand why, because
of course
it's so much of the process is, you know, what's the opening, particularly when we're talking vinyls, in a good old records, you know, what's your strong opener to side one? And then what's a real good closer to side one, which makes you want to pick it up and flip it over and get a great opener for side two. And that doesn't just come easily. It don't come easy. See, there's another one. Oh my goodness.
I just had an epiphany, David. Maybe that's why they released all the singles, because they wanted to be released as singles because they're so upset by the way Capitol was putting their music together on albums.
Well, this happened before all that. Before Capitol started messing with it. That was just a decision they'd taken, which was, we're going to release the singles. Because that was the chaos with Sgt. Pepper.
Right.
Because the first two songs they'd worked on and really were complete was Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields Forever.
Really?
Now, at that stage, John and Paul were talking about maybe doing a whole album of songs related to Liverpool and their childhood, etc., which, you know, with doing Penny Lane, Strawberry Fields Forever fits in perfectly.
Sure.
But, of course, they stopped the touring in August 66. John's doing How I Won the War. They're doing, you know, a few little projects, then coming back together. And Come Together. There's another one. Oh, my goodness. I'm sorry. I apologize in advance.
Just let it be.
Oh, hey, that could work in a song, you know. No, we'll get back to the original. Okay. So Brian says in the February of 67, we've not put anything out and it's been too long. Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields, they're ready. They're going out as a double A side. We've got to release something. So, of course, they come out as a single, which means they can't be on the album. So the idea of maybe crafting a Liverpool album was gone by then. And they come up with this second-rate idea of a Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. That'll never catch on.
No.
It was all right, wasn't it? It did well.
Yeah, pretty good. And then Magical Mystery Tour, when they're touring, well, that's where I ended up seeing or listening to those.
On the EP.
On the EP, yeah. And, you know, all the Blue Jay Way and Your Mother Should Know. And very, very, you know, of course, excellent. But to think for a moment that those two songs would be on Sgt. Pepper's is just odd, of course, about 50 years later.
Well, it does, and think what an album that would have been. And it's one of those. Do you know what a strange thing was? On my YouTube channel, we put up polls, and we're doing different ones. And it seems a funny thing that every time we put up a poll for rating your favorite Beatles album, Sgt. Pepper doesn't do as well as I was sort of expect, because like in like Rolling Stone magazine, and they do the 100 greatest albums and stuff.
Right.
And we know near the top, you're going to get Dark Side of the Moon from Floyd, and you're going to get Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. They're always there. But it's funny with Beatles albums, on so many times I either take part in or you know, I see one of these polls, it isn't Sgt. Pepper that comes out, and it will be, and normally it's Abbey Road, Revolver, and Rubber Soul. They tend to be the three that come up ahead of Sgt. Pepper. So I don't know whether it's a perception outside in the music world that because it was a game changer. And again, that's the problem for young people like us, who weren't there, you know, and when the albums were actually coming out,
right,
and following that progression, and how mind blowing Sergeant Pepper would have been, because we're looking back, knowing what came afterwards,
right.
So we don't get that same experience, which is why I like talking to the first generation Beatles fans, and saying, you know, what was it like? You know, Rubber Soul comes out, you know, Revolver comes out, and a friend of mine said, you know, he was only young, and when those two albums came out, he was unsure.
Hmm.
He thought, I'm not quite sure if I like those. And the Monkees were suddenly becoming big.
That's right.
And there's quite a few who sort of went, do you know what, I might just leave the Beatles for a bit and go off with the Monkees or go off with the Stones or Dave Clark Five or somebody else. But then when they play the album longer and longer, I think, no, actually, I can see what they're doing. And they move back in. Because I think they were controversial. Because, again, they were game-changing. Every time they're doing one of these albums, they're playing with, you know, it's all like experience to try and give the listeners something new, something different. And sometimes it didn't always work.
Hmm.
You know, there's some songs which think, yeah, I'm not quite sure of that one. I think the White Album is just, it's quite a confusing album.
Sure is. Yeah.
But could you knock that down to a single album?
Yeah, we talked about this last time. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I would do it in a moment. Yeah. Yeah.
That's the one that divides everybody, is that album.
But quite frankly, I might say that to every double LP from any band. You know, I don't think it's just inclusive to the Beatles. And 67, if I'm not mistaken, here in the States, the Monkees sold number one and the Sgt. Pepper was number two, I believe, for the year.
Right.
It was a very, very odd time. And you know, the Monkees, which was very different band. I mean, they were, you know, everything was written for them and you know, still talented, but just in a very different way. So what was the time frame? So they stopped touring, and then of course John had the bad you know, Jesus comment. Around when was that? Was that around that time?
Yeah, that was still 66. Because that was what that was cropping up just before they were doing their final tour.
Mm.
So Brian had to go over, do the first apologies and renegotiate the tour. John had to then, when they went over there, do his apologies and all those press conferences and stuff. And that's when they had all of that panic of the death threats and everybody coming out and you know, the mass hysteria, the burning of the albums.
Right.
All that kind of stuff. And I can't remember which, but it's one of the concerts when a firecracker went off and everybody else on the stage turned and looked at John because they thought maybe he'd been shot.
You know, Martin Luther King was assassinated, right? We had Nixon here. We were going into Vietnam. It was just a very, you know, hippies were coming. It was a very different time that it's hard for us sometime later to kind of grasp that.
Yeah. And you'd had, of course, JFK.
JFK as well. Good point.
Then, of course, yeah. Bobby Kennedy as well.
Bobby. Yeah. 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 So it was a very, I just remember reading about, the Jesus comment and then people in the South were burning Beatles. So then, you know, that may have had some influence on the acceptance of this, you know, world-changing album, Sgt. Pepper's. It's fascinating how music is the backdrop to all of this kind of turmoil that happens.
Yeah.
I feel pulls it all together.
Absolutely. You know, do you think that they were a pop group from Liverpool in England?
Yeah.
Who suddenly at press conferences had been asked for their views on American politics and the war in Vietnam.
That's right.
Now, that's gone a long way from the first ones of, you know, what you're going to do when the bubble bursts. You know, what you're going to do when the bubble bursts. Same old questions and you know, who cut your hair, what do you call it? Yeah. All that stuff with the, you know, with the first tour. Suddenly, this pop group from England is getting involved and being asked all about American politics. you know, how does that happen? And of course, you know, we Liverpudlians are quite shy and we obviously don't like talking a lot in public, as you can tell.
Yes, certainly.
Yeah. So if we get asked a question, we'll answer it.
Yes.
And of course, they were asked the questions and they answered them.
Who was the one who they said, how did you find New York? And he said, I went to Greenland and took a left. Was that?
Oh, yeah.
Is that George? That was with...
Yeah, I'm a judge. Yeah. How did you find America? Turn left at Greenland.
That's what he said. Yeah.
It's great. That. What do you call that haircut, Arthur?
That's right. Just that sarcasm. To me, it's very funny. And, they just took over America. I mean, people were getting lunch boxes and, you know, all that, you know, and the haircuts. And it was absolutely amazing time. And of course, Ed Sullivan, that was 64, I believe, right?
Yeah. And again, funny enough with dates. So Ed Sullivan is the 9th of February, 1964, exactly 3 years to the day earlier. The Beatles made their first appearance at the Cavern Club.
Wow.
9th of February, 1961.
Wow.
And they hadn't even been a rock and roll band for 12 months at that stage.
Absolutely.
They'd just
amazing.
Come back from Hamburg. And it was Mona Best rang Ray McFall at the Cavern and said, I've got this great group called the Beatles. Said they pack out the Casbah and everywhere they go, I think they'd go down really well at the Cavern. And so Mona got the Beatles into the Cavern. And exactly 3 years to the day later, from appearing in front of 200 or 300 kids down at the Cavern, they're in front of, was it 73 million in America?
Wow.
That is a scale, isn't it?
Absolutely.
In just 3 years. It's mad.
You wonder if the Beatles were, I know this always gets tossed around, I'd like to hear your opinion, but I mean, if the Beatles were around today with all the technology that's available and the tracking and would it have made a difference? Would it, do you think the music would have been better or do you think it would have been different at all?
Well, they were always pioneers of technology, you know, and a lot of credit always goes to the engineers at EMI Studios because, you know, a lot of the time they're working on four track, so they have to be very creative, and then they start getting more. But they were taking all these different gadgets home and would come up with an idea and sort of say, right, I want it to sound like this. And you hear the tales of them with the tape machines and then dragging it out with a pencil.
Right.
Somebody standing a long way away and putting a loop in and then trying to make it go backwards and coming up with different sounds. So whatever the new technology was, as it was coming out, they were buying it, experimenting with it and playing with it and seeing what it could do. And I think that would still be the same today. Whatever new toys and gadgets were coming out, they go for it. They play with it and do what they could. And if they didn't like it, they'd get somebody to say, I think that could be better by doing this. I think they would always have been at the forefront. That's what they were doing right the way through their career, is pushing the boundaries, you know, trying experiments with, whether it's with feedback, whether it's the Indian sitar, different percussion, all these kind of things. They were always trying something different. Now, perfect. As you say, it didn't always work.
Right.
But they were experimenters.
Perfect example is Tomorrow Never Knows. I believe it's only one chord.
I mean, that... how you do that.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing song. And again, you listen to, it's one of those where I think you can pull apart some of the main instruments and you just listen to it and think, how have they come up with that?
Right.
And it's, when you go back to when they're starting with their songwriting, you know, and everything's in three chords and maybe they experiment and they get to four chords. And then a lot of it is when they're starting with their recording career, they're not the most complex of songs. And then within a matter of years, you look at like something like Tomorrow Never Knows. You know, how do you do that?
Right.
And I think that, again, I use the word genius a lot because that's what they had. And there was something special when they got together. And we should also credit, you know, George and Ringo, because just coming up with a song which was mainly John and Paul. But once they get into the studio, the others are adding in, well, I think we could do this. How about that? Now, and this is where, when I was doing the Finding the Fourth Beatle book, was trying to say, Ringo wasn't just a guy who sat at the back and played whatever. He was contributing so much, not just in the rhythms, but with the percussion he was bringing in. But he was such a creative drummer. And I think Tomorrow Never Knows, with that and with Rain, right, I think two of his finest hours. I mean, his drumming is just superb. But you could see that all the way through. So all four of them are involved. And when you get that kind of mix of four people that are so creative and you get them in a studio, whatever comes out is going to be better than what went in. And and that's what I'm hoping with, you know, we get back. Now we're going to get 6 hours.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
I mean, because obviously we had the Let It Be, the Michael right. Lindsay Hogg version. And of course, a lot of that's around the rooftop concert, you know, which is still fantastic.
Sure.
You're not going to do much with that. But it's those little bits that we've seen over the years of them all being in the studio and it being quite fraught.
Right.
You know, and George storming out and having his arguments and, you know, it not being a good place. But from what Paul and Ringo have been saying, having seen the cuts of what Peter Jackson's done, he's saying, it's a lot better than I remembered.
That's right.
And it was actually a very positive time. Yes. And I think that's what we're going to see. And hopefully we'll get that glimpse of, here's these four guys in the creative process, working on these songs and seeing what each of them is contributing to the songs. That's what I'm hoping for.
We have a show here on Sunday nights called 60 Minutes, and they were able to show, it's three stories, and they were showing a little bit more of the footage. And that was the recollection was, we had this vision of like everybody hated Yoko and she's just sitting there and everybody's quite cordial and we, you know, and they hate each other and there's animosity. Sure, they had a couple of arguments, but I guess we're going to see it soon. They're saying we don't see that, but David, when I saw, I must have seen everything from the Beatles. I'm thinking to myself, I'm not going to get excited about this. I've seen everything. And then you see this video and it looks like it was filmed yesterday. It looks like John is turning around and talking to Paul. You get chills. It looks so recent and so vivid.
And you see what you said then? It's like it was filmed yesterday.
It does.
So you're doing it now. I do the jokes, remember? But that is
true.
That is what Peter Jackson brings. Did you see the First World War film that you did?
Oh, yes, I did see that. The Peter Jackson did. Yes, yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Right.
He made it fully colorized, but in HD.
Right.
And it just made it so real. And I thought, wow, if you can do that with something from like 1916,
17. That's right.
You're going to be able to do something pretty good with what came in 69. So we know quality-wise, filmically, it is going to look magnificent. We know that. But the fact that we've now got 6 hours of stuff and, you know, we've been waiting decades for this.
Yes. Yes. And it was like in some vault and nobody wanted to touch it. Peter Jackson was on the show and it, like nobody ever wanted to do anything with it. It was... Oh my goodness. You're going to be beside yourself when you watch that, aren't you?
Oh, it has been so firmly fixed into my schedule in my diary. I'm not going to miss this at all. It's been so long that we've waited for this. And I think it's going to be good. I think it's going to be very positive as well. And I think it'll make people feel a little bit better about the Beatles and their relationship at right. that time. Because, you know, with other things that have come out over the last 12 months or so, you know, there's then recordings of conversations where the four of them were actually talking about making another album after Abbey Road.
Right.
So it wasn't all as bad. You know? And I still think, you know, Abbey Road being the last album they record together, it's an absolutely brilliant album.
Absolutely.
And that tends to be the one that comes out at the top for me as my favourite album. And I think, well, if the four of them are still able to put that together, yet you could see there'd be the possibility of an album that could follow that. You know, and even if they had done that idea of, well, let's keep doing our solo stuff, and then every 2 years, let's get together again and let's do an album together. Unfortunately, the relationships have broken down so much by then.
Sure. Yeah. They did something together. Abbey Road, I would listen to that so much. And there was a part in Maxwell's Silver Hammer where my mother's album had one little skip in it. So the line was, Joan was quizzical, studied past the physical. I forget exactly. Yeah. And it would skip. And I would just, when I sang out loud, I would just sing with that skip. And when I heard it eventually on CD, I forgot that there's a whole line there. That's how ingrained that vinyl was to me.
That's amazing.
And then at the end, of course, the last song on the first side, it just ends abruptly, right? She's so heavy, right? It doesn't fade out. It just ends. No. And it just cuts. I thought it was my mother's record system was picking up the needle too quick. I was like, Mom, this thing is cutting off the song. You know, me as a little seven-year-old, disobedient child who wants to hear the entire song. But, you know, these are the stories that, you know, just kept listening to this music, and I can't imagine any of those songs apart. You'd hear Good Day Sunshine by itself, or you'd hear Come Together by itself, or something, right? So by themselves. Yeah. But in my head, the next song would play right after that song was over. I just married all the songs together, and that's the way they intended. Now, please don't tell me the Beatles didn't like that order that we had here in the States, right? That was the correct order. Abbey Road was correct, right?
I think you had the Abbey Road correct,
I hope so. Definitely Sgt. Pepper's.
Yeah. I think it had to, particularly because, you know, with side two, with everything sort of blending into each other.
Sun King, she left her money. Yeah, absolutely.
They have to come as a block. And maybe, I don't know, but, you know, maybe that's their sort of have a go at Capital. Come on. Let's see what you can do with that, because they all go into one song. Have fun with that.
And at that part at the end, the song at the end, where they're George, Paul, and John are like playing leads right off of each other, right? One's going, the next going, and they're going back and forth, and they're all kind of complimenting each other, and it's just, it's just absolutely wonderful. So when I talk about an entire album that, like, we don't really hear much albums these days, but all the songs belong together. For me, it would be Abbey Road. Yeah, that would be first.
Yeah,
I think the one little stain on Sgt. Pepper's, and I know you're going to disagree with me, is With In or Without You.
No, I'm with you.
Are you really?
I'm with you. I'm not without you. Yeah.
You can't help it.
No, unfortunately, that's one of those songs I refer to as skip.
I do too.
So when it comes on, I go, skip.
Yeah. I would move the needle to the next song.
When you got CDs, it was so much easier.
Oh, yeah. I don't know quite why, what happened there, because the process wasn't very democratic, the way John and Paul decided to have what songs on each album, right? It's pretty much their way or no way.
Well, yeah, because they were the dominant songwriters.
Right.
And they would, you know, have at least a song for Ringo to sing. And then we're allowing then George to have a couple of songs of his on there. But they were always going to be predominantly the two main songwriters. Because, and when you think about it, it's one of those things sometimes is skipped over, which is when they signed their new management contract with Brian, 1st of October 62, they also signed the song publishing agreement with Dick James. And that was that John and Paul would have the largest rights. Brian would have some. Then there was a little bit at the end for George and Ringo.
I didn't realize that.
And so right from the start of their recording career, it's about John and Paul, not about George and Ringo. and the money to be made if you're going to do it in big, big sales was in the publishing. That was one of the main ways they got into Parlophone originally. I think that they were original songs. So because you're only getting, it's like a penny per record sold, which had to be split between them all.
Wow.
You'd need to sell a hell of a lot to make money just on records. That's why you need concerts, but that's why you need the song publishing deal. And so it was set up that John and Paul would be the main songwriters, which they were, because, you know,
right,
George wasn't writing at the time.
At the time. Isn't it a pity, and, you know, What Is Love and All Things Must Pass not get on the White Album? Because they recorded them like at that time, right? Yeah. And Saffrey Trouble and Revolution Number 9 and, I don't know, Bungalow Bill, these songs got on.
Wild Honey Pie.
Wild Honey Pie, exactly.
I can't abide that.
Yeah. Can you imagine if Isn't It a Pity was on there? It would have been perfect.
What a song that is.
Beautiful. He did two versions. I love them both.
Yeah, brilliant.
Brilliant.
He was as good. And yes. that's one of the reasons I love Abbey Road, is because George's songs are on a par with John and Paul's.
Yeah, they are.
George must have been thinking, exactly as you say, I've got these songs. These are really good songs.
Yes.
And you're putting those songs on the album?
Right.
Rubbish. Then he goes home and writes Wah Wah because he was sick of it all.
But there are masterpieces. Cry Baby Cry, you know, there are masterpieces on that album, on that set.
Absolutely.
They're just, and in the States they had, I don't know, 4x7, like, you know, headshots of each of the Beatles, and they were beautiful. They were, you know, one of each, and that came with the album set, I remember. And that's not an album I would play from beginning to end, though. I would pick and choose.
And that's one of those, it's where I like the shuffle button. You know, and I'll stick it, you know, if I'm driving along, stick it on my phone in my music app. Stick it on shuffle, and the finger is ready. My skip finger is there, preloaded. And if I took the time, those tracks we were talking about, I would take them off.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would just not have them.
Now, you wrote two new books since we talked.
Yeah, well, I had nothing to do for a little bit.
You're busy. You would write two books. What are they about? Tell me they're
about them. I've published two books since we talked. I've been working on them a little while. The first one is the Beatles Fab Four Cities. And this is one that it was almost finished when the COVID pandemic hit. And it's one that I'd come up with the idea of a few years ago. I mean, when I first went to New York, because I always wondered, why would John Lennon want to live in New York?
That's right. He loved New York City.
So I didn't get it. And then I visited New York for the first time and I got it straight away. New York is just a very big Liverpool.
Yeah. Is it really?
Absolutely. They've got so much in common. They're cosmopolitan port cities. They've got this amazing mixture of nationalities in there, different musical influences coming in, and you get something with a port city, it brings up a different mixture of cultures that creates something amazing. And then I thought, well, London's like that as well. And then I realized, well, hang on, Hamburg's the same. And if you've got four cities that define the Beatles' career, it's Liverpool, Hamburg, London, New York. So picking on the idea of, John has said, the Beatles were born in Liverpool but grew up in Hamburg. So I paraphrase it and add, they reached maturity in London and immortality in New York.
Wow.
And then I thought, well, I can't do all this myself because I'm not a native New Yorker, as you can probably tell from the accent.
What?
Yeah, no, sorry to break it to you.
Wow.
Scattered the illusion.
I should have asked that first.
And I'm definitely not from London either. So my friend Richard Porter, who's been a tour guide down in London and been a friend of mine for donkey's years, I said, why don't we do this together? And then we've got a good friend of ours, Susan Ryan, who's a Beatles tour guide in New York. And we said, why don't the three of us collaborate on this? So that's what we decided to do. We got a publishing deal with ACC Art Books. And we met with them and said, this is our idea. Said, you want to paint a picture of each of the four cities? It'll show the progress of the Beatles, how they were influenced by them. But the most important thing is the connections between them, which there's lots of Beatles connections, but there's lots of geographical connections as well. Now, the cities that, as I was saying, all ports almost have like an independence to them. You know, Liverpool just happens to be in England by coincidence. We don't think of ourselves in a way as English. It's Liverpool first. London is like a country on its own within the UK. It's got its own identity. Hamburg is like that in Germany. Has always had its own identity. Politically as well. You know, seen itself as self-contained. New York's got its own identity very, very strongly. So we see these connections and the fact that the four cities have been trading with each other, sometimes going back hundreds of years. They've got all these links. And so we've done like a, here's the most important Beatles events. Here's the most important venues they played in. We've done some maps, which my daughter designed, which are fabulous. Got some photos, clips, some interviews. So we've got each of the four cities. But then in each one, we draw out the connections. And some of them are amazing. And it's not been done like that before. And as we were going through the process, the three of us, we were learning stuff about each other's cities and learning about these various connections. So that one has just come out, the Beatles Fab Four Cities. And the other one that just come out, it's a photographer called Bill Zygmunt. And he got in touch with me about 3 years ago. And he was a photographer who went freelance in about 1966. He became friendly with John and Yoko. So he had the very first photo of John and Yoko in the same picture. He did the last pictures of the two of them before they headed off to New York. You know, and they're amazing photos. So in total, we've got, it's well over 200 photographs he's taken. Wow. So it's John and Yoko. They've got Beatles. He's the only guy who did the psychedelic caravan, John's psychedelic Rolls Royce. And the famous photos of the Apple boutique, the Beatles set up with that psychedelic wall art on, which had to come down very, very quickly. So Bill took those photos as well. So you've got all these are John and Yoko, all the Beatles ones, but then a lot of the other bands from the time. So he did great interviews with Jimi Hendrix, some great photos. First ones of him together with The Experience, did those in London. Other bands like The Move, all kinds of amazing ones. And then we still got some from the 70s and the 80s as well. Some amazing stars. Wow. And he's a very, very interesting photographer. He wasn't just taking, there's a snapshot, it's a head and shoulders. He was very creative where he'd have the setting for the photos. So he's got the Bee Gees in the 60s just as they're starting their career. But the thing that came out was the Space Hopper. Do you ever remember those? That like a big balloon type thing you'd sit on and you'd bounce around on. I had one as a kid. So he was introducing those and he was getting celebrities to bounce around on these things and have the picture taken. And so I said to him, you know, we can put the photos together, but what makes it interesting is I want to know the stories behind the photos. So what we did was I then interviewed him about each of the photographs. He told me the story of how it came about, how he met them, what the plan was. And then I've added in just some other bits of context of, you know, who the group were, if it's somebody maybe not everybody would know about. Just a little bit of background. And we've just come up with this incredible book that a friend of mine, Paul Skellett, has designed. And Paul's done an amazing job with it. So we just launched that. and we're doing a limited edition run of only 250. And there's a free photo signed by Bill in there of John on the Top of the Pops program over here when he was performing Instant Karma. So we've just done that as well. So that one has literally just come out. So my friend Mark Lapidos, who does a lot of promoting for my books over in the States, and he said, so in my catalogue, I've got three books that you've just published. He said, Paul McCartney released McCartney 3 in Rockdown. He said, so David Bedford's published three books in Write Down. I like that one. I like that one. I'm going to use that.
Wow.
It keeps me in mischief. It's what I love doing.
Yes.
And just launched a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
Because I joined the company Bright Moon Media in Liverpool. So I'm now a director of the company. And I think we mentioned last time we did this documentary Looking for Lennon.
That's right.
So that Roger Appleton was the director of that film. And he and I have got on so well that we're now working together on various projects. And I said, I think we should have a YouTube channel. We do little clips of some of the films. So we thought, let's just give it a go. So we set it up. I think it was July we started. We've just gone past 700,000 views.
Wow.
We've got about 1,300 subscribers.
Wow.
Already.
And what's the name? I don't know this one. What is the name of it? How can we find that?
The name is Bright Moon, Liverpool. Okay. So Bright Moon is one word. Bright Moon, Liverpool. And we've got, I think it's about 16, 17 videos. So, and what I've started to do, so we're having some clips from the films we've made. We'll have clips from interviews we've never used. But then I've just done my first one where I've gone out around Liverpool and I'm doing like a mini tour. So just put the first one up of me giving a little guided tour Julia Lennon's house. So there'll be more of those. So just going to keep doing those. So there's going to be new content, new interviews with people all related to the Beatles and Merseybeat, et cetera. That has just gone completely mad. We had no idea what was going to happen.
Congratulations. So, by the way, there's a beautiful song, Julia. You know, I named my first daughter Julia.
That's a wonderful, wonderful song.
Wonderful song.
Yeah.
You could feel it. You could feel him, you know, in his, you know, you could, oh God, it's moving. It's a moving song.
And you know, half of what I say is meaningless.
That's right.
I think, wow, that just in a sentence, it is beautiful.
And honest. You know,
yeah. And Julia was so important. And that's why I've started with Julia Lennon's house. Because that's where she taught John to start playing the guitar using banjo chords. Now, letting the Quarrymen come around and rehearse there, listening to Buddy Holly's song. Now, going to a neighbor to learn to play the harmonica. This was a crucial part of John's life, was that getting together with his mum again. And those about 3 years where they were close, she had such a profound influence on him. And then, of course, you know, she was taken away.
Right.
But Julia, wow, beautiful, wonderful. Beautiful song.
Wonderful. Yeah. That absolutely wonderful. Well, David, thank you so much for your time. You're the first guest I've had that I've interviewed twice.
I am honored.
Yes.
Because, thank you very much.
And I feel we can do so much more. I could talk about the Beatles all the time. My favorite of all time. I know a tiny fraction of what you know, but I love it and have a little passion for it. Not as much as you, but I want everybody who's listening to go to, I'll put all this in the show notes, but definitely go to Bright Moon, Liverpool, get your books, get more insight. Now, you mentioned at one point kind of casually, you know somebody in New York who does Beatles tours as well. Susan Ryan, I think you said?
Susan Ryan, yeah.
Yeah, very good. I'm in the city quite often, so I will reach out. I'll ping you next time and contact her. I'd love to, meet up with her.
She's brilliant. You know, native New Yorker.
Right.
She's great. I've done her walking tour with her. It's fascinating. And there are so many places that you won't realize. You know, she'll pick up, you know, some of the ones connected to John Lennon as well as the Beatles as well. It's a fascinating tour. honestly. Wow. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I've been by the Dakota many times where he lived. I, you know, they did a an
strawberry
area
fields.
That, right, strawberry yeah. fields in Central Park. But yeah, I didn't realize there was much more. David, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I can't wait to meet you face to face and watch some English football and watch my city continue to take over that league.
Is what we want. Man City, I remember them.
You do? Yeah. Well, they're the champions. You should be able to remember. I love Liverpool. I love watching Liverpool. I don't have any. Around here, I have plenty of teams I don't like. But EPL, yeah. I will watch every game and love it. And we could talk about that another time. But yeah, I absolutely love it. The team that makes the beer, the great beer, Newcastle, they got new owners. Yeah. What's going to happen with them? And United just fired their manager. And wonderful level of soccer, highest level of soccer in the world. I just can't get enough. David, thank you so much for your time. And I look forward to meeting you face to face. You be well, my friend.
And you take care.
Bye. See now. You.
Bye.
Thank you for listening and or viewing Joey Pinn's Discipline Conversations. Please share this episode with one or two of your friends who you think may benefit from the episode. Our website, www.joeypins.com. There you find lots of resources and you could join our mailing list. Please follow us on all our social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Podcast information, the video version of our podcast is on YouTube. Please subscribe. Audio is on all major podcasting platforms. Please follow them. And if you like it, please consider giving 5-star rating. Would really appreciate that. Would you like to financially support the podcast? You can go to our Patreon site. Consider $5, $10, or $20 a month. There's all kind of plans that we have there. It's like a one-time payment. What is this podcast episode worth to you? $25, $50, $100, $500, $1,000, $5,000. You be the judge. You can go to our PayPal account to do that as well. Thank you again for listening or watching Joey Pinn's Discipline Conversations.